The enemy has very deceitfully taken advantage of the Tet ceasefire to launch an offensive all over the country. In Saigon, the United States Embassy has been overrun by suicide squads. Khe Sanh is standing by to be overrun. We also have reports that a division of NVA has occupied all of the city of Hue south of the Perfume River. In strategic terms, Charlie's cut the country in half. The civilian press are about to wet their pants. And we've heard even Cronkite's going to say the war is now unwinnable.
Sir, does this mean that Anne Margaret's not coming?
Whose side are you on, son?
Our side, sir.
Don't you love your country?
Yes, sir.
Then how about getting with the program? Why don't you jump on the team and come on in for the big win?
Yes, sir.
Son, all I've ever asked of my Marines is to obey my orders as they would the word of God. We are here to help the Vietnamese because inside every gook is an American trying to get out. It's a hardball world, son. We've got to keep our heads until this peace craze blows over.
Hello, and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this week to talk about Stanley Kubrick's 1987 classic Full Metal Jacket is a former active duty Marine who served from 1990 to 1996, my friend Terry Mahoney. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. This is like a big deal because this is an amazing movie, and this is one of those things where I really wanted to have someone who knew the world this movie inhabits, and that is certainly not a world that I know anything about. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have Terry here on the show. Let me just start out, like, Terry, like, when did you see this movie for the first time?
I saw it for the first time, and you know what? I saw it before I was a Marine. And I know I saw it before I was a Marine, because I was born in 1970, so I was allowed to see this movie in 1987, 17 years old, right? It was rated R, and I know I saw it before I went in because it was a big deal. My sister was already in, and her husband was a Marine as well, so they went and saw it. She had talked about it to me, and I think I saw it in the theater, but I certainly saw it on HBO and on tape, and I saw it many times before I left for boot camp. I signed up for the Marine Corps. I went in and signed the contract. This recruiter was like, he was P.T. Barnum, and I was the sucker, man. I signed up for 6 years, which is two more years than I had to. I signed up for a guaranteed overseas duty assignment. Like, I wanted them to send me somewhere else. And I signed up to be a machine gunner. Now, since you've seen this movie, that's Animal Mother. That's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be Animal Mother, Adam Baldwin's character, who, by the way, was brilliant in this. You know what I mean? That's who I signed up to be. And at some point over the podcast, I will tell you how the Boy Scouts probably saved, at least changed my life. Well, you know, I'll tell you right now. I got to boot camp, and I realized what a colossal mistake I made in signing up to be a machine gunner. It's heavy. You know, I'm a big guy. You know, you showing up at boot camp, I was probably about 255 pounds. Maybe 260, maybe 250, but within that swing range, which is huge for a Marine. I was a fat body, too. So, you know, I was pretty overweight, but still strong. But they made me carry that M60 whenever we went anywhere with it. And they laughed about it. And they said, you're such a target. You're the number one target. The enemy is always going to shoot at the machine gunner first. And look how big you are, you moron. Ha, ha, ha. These are my drill instructors. These are the guys, like, training me to be a Marine. And I'm like, oh, my God. So in the Boy Scouts, I took the communications merit badge. And you have to learn a language of some sort or another. I chose Morse code. And because one of the scout leaders was a ham radio operator. So I chose Morse code, and I learned Morse code obviously well enough to remember some of it when I was in boot camp, and they gave me a battery of tests because I did really well in my ASVABs. I'm not a lunkhead. And so they gave me these extended tests, and I learned Morse code, and I knew Morse code, so I answered those questions, right? And we get all the way to the end of the boot camp, and here I think, I mean, I'm in a world of shit, you know, to quote the movie. Oh, my God, I have made a massive mistake, but I'm going to go through with it.
Wow.
They pull me into a small room and they say, so, Mahoney, instead of being a machine gunner, how would you like to be? And I locked my body and I screamed at the top of my lungs, sir, yes, sir. And they said, you don't even know what I'm going to say. And I looked at this guy as a master sergeant. I said, it can't be worse than machine gunner. So that's how I am not Animal Mother. And I was my job was a lot more like Joker's job, which was really cool and really fun, but we don't need to talk about it. But that's how the Boy Scouts saved my life. I had the best time in the Marine Corps because of the Boy Scouts. God bless them.
I do want to talk about the movie opens with this song over some credits and over shots of people getting their head shaved, which is something we've seen in a lot of, you know, movies, people enrolling in the military movies. It's a song written by Tom T. Hall and performed by Johnny Wright, Hello Vietnam. And it's a very kind of lopey, almost kind of welcoming song. And again, we've seen these guys get their head shaved, I mean, in Stripes and every version of a military movie.
Yeah.
We've seen this.
And
so we're kind of eased into this movie. And then we are hit in the face by the sounds of R. Lee Ermey as the sergeant. And we see our main characters, which is Matthew Modine as Private Joker, Vincent D'Onofrio, Arliss Howard as Private Cowboy.
Yep.
And, like, you're going to have to explain this stuff to me, Terry, because I'm coming at this from a muggle's perspective.
Yes.
I mean, the first half of this movie, I've read articles. There was an article that went around a couple of months ago by Anthony Swafford, who wrote Jarhead.
Sure, Swaff. Yeah.
And he said that the first half of this movie, all the drill instructor stuff, got a whole generation of men to sign up for the Marine Corps.
Hello.
And I have to ask you, Terry, what would you possibly see in this and say, yeah, I got to be part of that? Because this is fucking terrifying.
Yeah, well, I am not one of those, I'm an alpha male wearing my, you know, pulled down baseball cap and walking around with, you know, pumping my, you know, with imaginary lat syndrome. But that said, that out of the way, if you don't look at that and think, I can do that, I want to do that, then I can't really explain it to you. So if you think about it, let me put it to you from this perspective, because I know you've been in and understand the advertising world. Think about the way the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force advertise to get recruits. You know, learn a job, be this, fulfill your life, you know,
be all you can be, right?
Do all this stuff. Then the Marines commercial comes on and says, you know what, you're probably not good enough, but if you think you might be, come try. We dare you. That's basically what that is. Never once will you ever hear about college money in a Marine Corps commercial. You will never hear about what you'll, you know, the fulfilling nature of it. You will hear, do you want to be the best? I don't think you will be able to hack it, but come on, give it a shot. And so that's what that movie speaks to. And that's what the Marine Corps is. The Marine Corps is about being elite. Now, I'm not saying I'm elite, man. I was a pizza box, and the Marines who are listening will understand that. But that basically means I was just good enough with a rifle to get through boot camp, right? I'm a big guy. I could probably, you know, I learned enough hand to hand in boot camp. I felt like I was on top of the world, but I personally know ladies who would kick my ass. Even my 19-year-old Terry, you know what I mean? Just like, you know, that's not what I'm trying to say to you, but the attraction of being there, and then they reinforce it when you get there. Think about what do you think? I mean, the top five things they teach. You know, like there's in phase one of boot camp is the part before the shooting, right? And then the phase two is the shooting, and phase three is the sort of, okay, you're hard now. So now we're going to temper you and put you on the anvil and bang you into the shape of a sword, right? One, they're just getting out all the extra crap. They're refining the ore. Two, the fundamental. If you can't do this, you're not invited to be a Marine. That's shoot to kill at 500 yards. I mean, you have to be able to do that. So if you don't pass that, there's no sense in them wasting time on you in phase three, right? All throughout phase one. One of the most important lessons that we go to, I think if it wasn't every day, it was every third day, was history. We would sit and get lectures on Marine Corps history all the time. Everywhere we went, they would mention it. Everything was named after a famous Marine. You know, Manila John Barcelone. If you watched the Pacific, on HBO, which is fantastic, and I highly recommend it. You'll see the names to some of these people that things are named after. What the whole point of the Marine Corps is, we want you to beat the best. You want to be the best, and then when you get to boot camp, they tell you what the best is by telling you stories about who the best were. So you'll learn about Presley O'Bannon in, you know, 1805, I think, raised the shores of Tripoli, raised the American flag for the first time in I'm not on the North American continent when he stormed Derna, Tripoli, with seven Marines and some Greek and Egyptian mercenaries, right? And it's all bullshit political maneuvering, but hey, he did it. We'll learn about him. You learn about Chessie Puller. You learn about Smedley Butler, Dan Daly. These are icons of Marine history. Dan Daly was an enlisted man who stood in the Boxer Rebellion in China in 1898, was a private, brand new to the Marine Corps, was on the wall, and we were using Craig Jorgensen rifles then. These rifles were, you know, single shot, bolt action. I think they had a small magazine, 3, 4, 5 rounds, something like that. And you had to reload with a stripper clip from the top every time you needed to reload them. And he's standing on this wall, his section of the Peking Legation. And when the smoke clears the next morning, there's 500 corpses of Boxer rebels at the bottom of his wall. You know, and he, with bayonet, butt stroke, and bullets, that was his first Medal of Honor. He earned another Medal of Honor, so he's the only enlisted man to have two Medal of Honors. And then in the Battle of Belleau Wood, which is in World War I, which was the first battle the Marines really had an impact in World War I, I think it was the first 2 or 3 hours of that battle, more Marines died than before in combat. And I don't mean in any other battle. I mean combined in the history of the Marine Corps, more Marines died in the first few hours of the Battle of Belleau Wood in World War I. And you remember, of course, Coda and that iconic line that she says, come on, do you want to live forever? Right?
Valeria,
yeah. Yeah, Valeria. So Dan Daly turns to his troops and says, come on, you sons of bitches, do you want to live forever? And charges into the Marine Corps, into Jerry's machine guns, right? So this is what they teach you, and it gets instilled in you, and you never forget it. And the significance of this, and you may be thinking, oh, what the hell is Terry rambling on and on and on about? But think about it. Marines are the first to fight. We like to say that. But for Desert Storm, I was 2 kilometers away from that big berm before 95% of the Army even made it into the country. And we were sitting up there, and our unit was up there listening to enemy communications, like literally closer to the Iraqis in Kuwait than any other unit in the service, right? I'm sure there were special operation units that went all around, but my unit was strung out right there on the edge, and we had to be ready. And, you know, honestly, they had to bug out a couple times because when Saddam Hussein tried if you remember the news from that time, he would try those little armored incursions and get blown to hell. But before he did, our guys would have to either take off or tuck in, you know, and that's us. And I was not, and like I said, I got out of being the tip of the spear, the machine gunner. But the reason why those two things are important is because Marines are expected to go in to a shit show, an absolute shit show, and bring order. The latest Marine Corps advertising campaign, the one from a few years ago, was called Towards Chaos. And the commercials were all Marines running towards, whether it was combat or natural disaster. And it would show a Marine walking down the street in civilian clothes, and then he would just turn his head, or she would turn his head or her head, and then they would, towards the sound of something, and they would start running toward it, and it would, you know, transition into uniform and under combat load or whatever. And so this is what Marines do. And so you've got to think about it. We're going to be in the craziest situations ever, right? Even me, who's a pogue, I wasn't an infantryman. Even me was in a position to have to fight off the enemies, right? Cooks, bakers, who doesn't matter who it is. So you fight for the guys next to you, but you get ingrained with the tradition of glory and absolute bravery in the face of battle from the moment you step aboard Parris Island. And that's what that's about. That's what Arleigh Ermey's about, is ripping you down, breaking you down, and then they feed this into your head, and they say, yeah, you want to be the best. This is who you're going to have to be like, so that when you get in that situation, you think, well, fuck. Excuse my French. That's my one of five. I've promised myself only 5 F-bombs for this. What they tell you, you're going to have to do. And guess what? Marines are doing it every day. if you read about Iraq and Afghanistan, Marines are doing it every day over there during the war. And it's not a joke. And so when we see this movie and we see Arlie Ermey, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, when we see what he's doing and saying in this movie, it's emotional for us. We laugh. I mean, when it came on, I'm listening in the car, my poor kids, my son and my middle son and my daughter is in the back, and I turn it on, and it starts to be him just screaming, you know, like really ripping up whatever. And I'm dying. It's been a little while. It's been a week. So I'm laughing and laughing and laughing. And I think my daughter thought I might have been crying because I was trying to be quiet because they were trying to sleep. It was early in the morning. And I'm just laughing and listening to it because I know I'm going to have to talk to you about it, and you're just not going to get it. And you're going to think, why the hell would anyone want to subject themselves to that? And I knew your question was coming, and I'm sitting here thinking, I can't really explain it to you except that it ties us all together. I got to tell you something, one other thing, and then we can talk about Arlie Ermey and how and why he got the job and why that made this movie what it is. I was at my father-in-law's 40th anniversary of his diaconate. I was up there and I spoke, and I was the representative of the family. My father-in-law and I spoke, and I told him what his being a deacon meant to the family. And it was great. But I mentioned, of course, I was a Marine in it because I always mention I'm a Marine. And one of his parishioners, one of the guys in the audience, afterwards comes up, and you know, we just start talking. And we start talking. I say, hey, I'm going to do this. What are your thoughts to that movie? And he says, oh, my God, I love that movie. That movie's it. And I see, he said, this guy went in 1954, about 6 months before this guy went to boot camp. One of the most famous controversies in the Marine Corps, modern Marine Corps history happened. One of the drill instructors got shit-faced down at the slap shoot. And he went back to his barracks, rousted his entire platoon, you know, 70-something guys, middle of the night, got him in the combat load. He's drunk off his ass, and he takes him marching through the swamp. This was a swamp that they put him through. Now, they would put him through the swamp with four drill instructors, standing in the muck with him, making sure they got through. Well, this guy was drunk, and so he sent him through. And I can't remember, but four or five of them died. So anyway, we're talking about, he, just to put a frame of reference, that's 1950s. This guy went through 6 months later, and just to tell you what boot camp is like, he said, yeah, my drill instructor said, remember that? You heard about that in the news. Sir, yes, sir. Come on. Let me show you what we're not allowed to do anymore. And then they ran him through the swamp. This is what we're not allowed to do to you, and they're doing it to him. And my drill instructor did some of the same things to me. You know, like, we're not allowed to swear at you anymore. So, for instance, Mahoney, and this one doesn't count towards my limit because I'm quoting someone, okay? sir, for instance, Mahoney, I am not allowed to call you a sissy, faggot, motherfucking cocksucker. That's not allowed anymore. And, you know, they had code words for every single one of those words, and they would use them instead of that and just do, you know, and do it. So when I was talking to this gentleman about it, this we went through in 1954, I said, we had the same experience. And he said, yes. And I said, yours was different than Full Metal Jacket, and mine was different than Full Metal Jacket. But the spirit of that part of Full Metal Jacket was identical for both of us. And he said, that's it, the spirit of it. The details, yes, different. But the spirit of the experience of Paris Island and San Diego, which is what West Coast Hollywood Marines go to, the spirit of boot camp was identical. The towering tyrant, the senior drill instructor and his assistants. You know, this movie had one. We had basically four of them running around screaming at us the whole time. And that's why this movie is so significant to Marines. The second part of it often gets overlooked by Marines because some of them either don't like it or they, you know, it doesn't resonate with them. It wasn't like their experience. But that first part, for enlisted Marines, that first part was boot camp. It is. Whenever we watch it, it brings back our memories of boot camp. And memories of boot camp are great and always make you happy. And you want to know why? You'll never have to go there again. Never. You will never have to go to boot camp again. So any memory of boot camp is a great memory of boot camp. If it was good, it's good because it's good. If it was bad, it's good because you'll never have to do it again.
Well, I do need to ask you a couple of things because
all right, go ahead,
we need to get to some parts of this movie.
Whose show is this?
I mean, part of the reason this whole first half is so entertaining, and I think this is the reason that most people are much more affectionate towards the first half of this movie than the second half, is because Arlie Ermey is so funny. And in your experience, are drill sergeants that funny in their merciless drilling? I mean, he's very entertaining with the whole thing about the jelly donuts. I mean, not only is he insulting you, but he's very funny while he's doing it. Is that, to your experience, were they like that? Were they that clever?
So you're familiar with the greatest Christmas movie of all time, or Christmas Story, right? Right.
Of course.
My
of course.
Father worked in profanity like an artist would work in clay. Right. Right. And drill instructors are required. It's a required skill for them to have that instant, massive, evil wit. That wit that says, "I'm asking the questions here. You want to be in charge for a while, the sir." Yeah, what like those things that Arlie Ermey came back with. Now, this leads into a great little story. Arlie Ermey was originally obviously not cast for that role. You know that, right?
Right. The original drill instructor was Tim Kusari, who is the...
The door gunner. The door gunner.
The door gunner, yeah.
You should do a movie about me. I've got 157 cast. And the controversy around that is, did Arlie Ermey steal the role from him? Or did Stanley Kubrick say, "Holy shit"? Now, there's a couple of I got to have this guy. And there's a couple of perspectives. I think there's three possibilities here. One is Arlie Ermey said, "I'm going to take this role," because Arlie Ermey wanted the role, you know, and good for him. Two is, and this is, I think, what Modine writes about in his diary. And Modine thinks this is what happened. Tim Kulseri was supposed to try out. Most of the platoon was made up of the equivalent of British National Guardsmen. You know, they were just, they were the territorials, right? That's who the most 95% of the recruits were. And so to get to test the ones to see who they could respond, they had Tim Kulseri reading the lines of the drill instructor and seeing how, and he would go into, and then after 15 minutes, he's lose his interest. And then, you know, he would say, "Lee, can you do it? You're the whatever." And so Arlie Ermey would do it. He would go for hours drilling these guys and doing that, screaming at them and whatnot. And Kubrick saw that. And that was that for Kulseri, and Ermey had the role. Now, the third possibility is, and this is an emotional one, I watch movies about the Marine Corps, and when they're inaccurate, I want to freaking scream. I mean, how hard is it to get a Marine and say, "Watch as we're doing this and tell us when we screw up"? It can't be that hard. Like haircuts, the uniform, anything, right? You know, and so... I think Ermey saw what was happening, saw Tim Kulseri, and said, "That's not going to be the Marine Corps. That's not going." And Kubrick wants the Marine Corps on screen. I'm going to do this, and I think he took the role. But I think he took it, yeah, because he wanted it, but he also took it because he needed to take it. You can't be a drill instructor. You can't be that drill instructor unless you were a drill instructor, not that first one. And the Boys of Company C, you're familiar with that, of course, is my Army friends like to point that out, that he did that one as well, and he did an amazing job in that. As well,
I've heard of that movie, but I've never seen it.
I've never seen it either. But yeah, you really, he is like that. Drill instructors really are like that. They are all like that. They don't. I didn't get the physical violence. Was it? I got kicked in the head a couple times because I was like falling asleep while I was cleaning my rifle. You know what I mean? You're dozing off. I'm still cleaning my rifle, but my eyes are rolled back in my head. I'm so exhausted. And drill instructor Sergeant Manning came up and just stabbed me on the head with the sole of his boot, you know. All right. And then a couple of smacks in the back of the head. Yeah, but nothing, but not the choke yourself or the smacking on the drill. But always, no, it was never in public. It was always where there would be plausible deniability and never any injury involved or anything like that.
Was there anybody like Private Pyle who just didn't get it?
Yeah, well, no. Well, the difference then was that was Vietnam, and the Marine Corps prides itself on being an all-volunteer force. And sometimes during Vietnam, as I understand it, they went down the line and counted every 10th guy, a promising-looking guy, and said, "Hey, guess what you did? You just of the recruits," and they said, "You just volunteered for the Marine Corps." So that it may not have been 100%, but you got to remember that the guys who were in boot camp, portrayed in that movie, were supposed to have been people who stepped forward during Vietnam and said, "I want to be a Marine." So they got everyone. They got the Private Piles, and they got that. Now, when I went through, there was a lot more screening. You had to you spent a little time with your recruiter. You had to pass certain tests. You couldn't have a record. You couldn't whatever. You know, there's a little now. It's like a 6, 7, 8 month process, and you got to go to PT with them, and you have to learn it. And so you're showing up at boot camp knowing, you know, probably 50% of the facts and 10% of the attitude that you're going to need to get through it. They put a lot into it. So when I went through, yeah, we had a couple guys. We had a guy who knew that they would give you, he knew that if you smoked weed, you weren't allowed to smoke weed. So then they would piss test you on Parson. So he knew that they were going to do that and then send him give him and send him home. But he also knew that they would give him a waiver to keep him. And so he smoked weed on purpose before he went so that he would have the opportunity to get the waiver or go home. And he elected to go home. And it was probably a pretty good thing. And we had some sad sacks. We had this dude. He was about 6'3", maybe weighed 125, 140 pounds, something like that. Black dude. And he pissed himself. He pretty much, you know, every time we spent more than 2 hours away from a toilet, that dude pissed him. But he made it through, you know, and I guess he got it under control. And we had people that dropped. We had lots of people that dropped. And people try and kill themselves with safety razors. The Marine Corps doesn't want those people. They try and weed them out ahead of time. And they're there, but there's no private pause. I ran into them once we got into the Marine Corps, people who got through somehow. You know, they wouldn't have made it through in my platoon, but they got through somehow. And there's some worthless Marines out there that I ran into in the service, and we, you know, we dealt with it, not in that violent way, but, you know, you didn't let them impinge you. Because you got to remember, where you're going, you can die if they're worthless, right? It's not like you, you're going to have to just do a little extra work at work, right? Oh, my God, I'm teamed up with Terry. Crap, he's going to talk the whole time and not do any work. No, I was standing next to a guy who was going to have to shoot someone while I did my job to keep me from dying, you know? And so you didn't want them with you. But anyway, go on.
Well, I mean, the scene where they all decide to teach Pyle a lesson by hitting him with the bars of soap. And, of course, Joker, who's been put in charge of Pyle.
He's last and hits
the hardest. I mean, that scene is just nightmarish to me. Because to me, I mean, obviously I'm never going to be in this situation, but I feel like I'd be Pyle. I'd be the one who's screwing up all the time. And just the hitting him in the stomach with the bars of soap is just... I don't know. It's just nightmarish.
Leonard Lawrence's character, D'Onofrio, was, he deserves an Oscar. You know what I mean? He deserved an Oscar for that. And then he snapped at that point. And every moment after that, he was dead. He had the crazy dead eyes, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
But he got better. That fixed him as far as the Marine Corps was concerned, right? But yeah, at that point, and it's just a little aside, at that point in the movie, you know that Modine got him that job, right? Modine,
yes, yes.
They were friends. But one of them was D'Onofrio was Stella Adler, and Modine was the other school. So method actor essentially, D'Onofrio, and they had this sort of rivalry, and they knew what was coming. And D'Onofrio, they were pissed at each other. They were great friends, and they are great friends today. But D'Onofrio had ratted out Modine to Kubrick in a way that made Modine look amateurish, right? And Modine held a grudge, and they bumped gums. You know, they got pissed at each other. And then by the time that scene was being filmed, they weren't even speaking on set. And Modine wasn't acting at all when he hit him at that point. And that's great. That Full Metal Jacket Diary, you know, is such an insight into the making of this movie. And it's all Modine's a brilliant guy, and his writing is incredible. They were so angry. But yeah, and if you hear that scream, and then the my favorite part of that scene is when they all go back to their bed, and it's fucking, no, that's two. It's dead still. It's still as night, and all you hear is Private Pyle crying like a little baby, right? Mm-hmm. Just that little child who shouldn't be on Paris Island, and he's sobbing. So anyway, yeah, there you go.
I have to think that by the time of 1987, Stanley Kubrick was world famous, and if you're an actor... and you're volunteering to be in one of his movies, it's a little akin to volunteering to join the Marines. You know what you're signing up for. I mean,
exactly.
You're signing up for a shoot that's going to take probably over a year. It's going to be incredibly intense. I mean, and it's not something for everybody. I mean, it's in there's that Stanley Kubrick documentary where they have the footage of Shelley Duvall getting mercilessly berated by Kubrick on the set, and then they cut to her in present times, and she said, I wouldn't trade the experience for the world, but I wouldn't want to do it again, which sounds just like what you just talked about with basic training. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this, another thing about that, right? So in boot camp, you see in the beginning, Modine gets beat to hell, right? A couple times. Once when he says, "Is that you? Is this me?" And then, "Who said that? Who said that.
Which is insane. It's completely nuts that you would make a joke and mouth off to this guy.
But how did he know? He didn't know how serious this guy was, right? This was the opening. This was your introduction. And it really fits Private Joker's character. I mean, he's the guy who wears the peace button and the Born to Kill, right? And so he runs up to him and he pummels him and then he's on the ground and he's, you know, whatever. They took that scene how many times? And then there's the other time when he says, you know, the Virgin Mary herself would be proud to take a dump in that head, right? And then he said, "You believe in the Virgin Mary?" And he goes, "No, sir, no, sir,
sir, no, sir."
And that's what I think he gets slapped around there again, right? Those takes took forever, ever, ever, because of course Kubrick wouldn't accept it until it looked like he actually got slapped, right? So this took forever, and everyone else is watching it, and everyone else is standing at attention. I gotta tell you, that's a pain in the ass to stand at attention. And so when they're on the parade ground, and Vincent D'Onofrio's character is to the left, this is your right, this is your left, there are two scenes in this movie that I guarantee you there were only one take taken. That was one of them, because D'Onofrio said to Kubrick and Ermy, "Hit me. Make it real. Make it like you just haul off and hit me." And they did it in one take. That whole thing was done in one take, which is insane for Kubrick, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
The other scene that was done in one take, and I'm going to fast forward way to the end, is, you know, the sniper scene in the end with that girl, the little Viet Cong sure. girl, and she gets shot, and all those blood packs are bursting on her, and she's getting hit, bop, 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 right? And she's dying, right? Well, they could only do that one take that time, and then Kubrick went through and looked at it again, and then he showed it to the girl, and she ran out of the room screaming, and so he could not refilm it, so that was the other one. Wow. He was foolish for showing it to that girl, but, you know, of course he's like, well, this is a little human. He doesn't understand girl, you know, growing up, whatever. I didn't feel like, you know, I felt like this. So those are those are the only two scenes in the movie that were done in one take. And it speaks to the whatever the question was that you asked me that sort of led me there.
Well, the idea that you would volunteer for this, the idea that,
for a Kubrick movie, yeah.
As an actor, you would sign up for this. And I mean, you know, Matthew, I did want to mention just briefly where they were in their career. Matthew Modine was on the way up. He had done Vision Quest, Birdie and Mrs. Yeah. Softball. I mean, and a lot of really kind of high-minded stuff. He was not a like a blockbuster actor. He was like an actor's actor, and so he was definitely in line of this kind of stuff. And D'Onofrio had only done one movie previously, which is Adventures in Babysitting, which is like, that's
and
the
he had
greatest,
like a walk-on, too. He wasn't even, yeah. It was like one-liner.
Amazing 1-2 punch to go from Adventures in Babysitting to Full Metal Jacket. But of course, this movie made his career.
Well, he speaks about that. If you watch any of the, if you go on YouTube and watch any of the whatever, he, whenever asked about it, he goes, Every day I thank Stanley Kubrick when I wake up in the morning. The man made my career. I've had the most amazing life because he picked me.
Right.
And, you know, the guy, he's not messing around. Modine, you know, credits him. Everyone credits him. You know, they might have screamed at him. But anyway, so going back, I do want to finish with Hartman and that, because that's one of the ones I starred for. You must not talk about it for that long. He was perfect because he had done the job. I think that not any drill instructor, but almost any drill instructor could have stepped in. There's a possibly apocryphal story about how he got the job, and is that, you know, when he was standing there and Kubrick was making up his mind whether or not to switch to Ermy for that role, Ermy said, "Listen, I'll stand in the middle of the room. You have these jokers throw orange whatever at me, and I will scream at you for 15 minutes straight, and I won't repeat myself." And he did it, and I think there's footage of it, and people are throwing, like, shoes at him, they're throwing fruit at him, and they're doing it, and he's just sitting there doing it. And at the end of it, Kubrick just has to know one thing. He just has to know one thing. He goes, Lee, what's a reach around?
Oh, right, yeah, Kubrick did not know what that was.
Yeah, we didn't know what a reach around was. So that's it. I think we could do a whole podcast on Ermy and how he made this movie. There are so many elements of that movie that this movie wouldn't be this movie without those elements, but Ermy's got to be the biggest one. So anyway.
I love how aghast he is when he is reading the assignments for everybody after they've graduated.
Holy shit!
Yeah, and most of them have that same number. Yeah, most of them have. And like, it's like, well, the thing is, it's like, if you're someone who's not familiar with this world, right, and he's reading off the code numbers, you know, and he's like 0220 infantry, 0220
0300, but yeah, 0300.
Excuse me, 0300 infantry. And you're like, okay, well, most of them are going to have that number. And then when he gets to Joker,
4812.
He's like, 4812, and you're immediately like, wait a minute, that's way off. Way off the beam as ever of everybody else. And he's like, that whole line about, you know, military journalism, holy shit, do you think you're Mickey Spillane? I love that, that to a drill instructor, a journalist is Mickey Spillane. Like, that's right, his reference that's a journalist.
But and the other thing is, I want to point something out. Well, we can get into that. Actually, I'm going to file that away. So I want to step back, though, and all right, Kubrick. We touched on it a little bit. I definitely wanted to step back, and we could also talk about Kubrick forever, you know, right? You could do a podcast about just his idiosyncrasies.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, man, reading this Full Metal Jacket Diary, I mean, I knew a bunch about him because I took a film class in college. Well, just recently, I just got my AA from the veterans, you know, a VA program sent me back to school. God bless the VA. I'm glad I did it now because when I was young, I was just really like, yeah, Kubrick, Schmubrick. But now I'm a little bit more appreciative because of this movie. And, man, he's incredible. But then just reading about it, dude would hold his, like, how he wanted to frame the scene. He had a little lens that he would hold up. And then there were two guys that's job was to go and mark it with a plumb bob, the spot on the ground, and write the exact height over the spot that he picked where the lens had to be, like down to the millimeter, right? And just hundreds of takes. You remember the wall at the end? They're all lined up against that wall, and they film against it, and they got to attack over it for the snipers there and all the rest of that, that busted-up wall they're behind. They spent something like a month and a half or 2 months of shooting the scenes involved with that wall. And they called that their Waterloo. I mean, that was just hell on earth for them. And he just did it because, and some days they'd wait all day for the weather to change and it would never change. And they would be out there in October, November, December in England, right? Filming a movie set in Way City, Vietnam. And you know, freezing their asses off when they're supposed to look hot. And then waiting for him to say go for the light to be right or whatever the hell, you know, whatever clicked in his head. You can look at that and say, oh, Martinet and bullshit. But then when you look at the final result and you look at Full Metal Jacket or you know, Clockwork Orange or The Shining, you go, yeah, no, you can't challenge that. And that's why I don't think, you know, I was laughing about this because there's never been a director's cut for any of his movies, right?
No.
Yeah, because the movie that's produced and comes out is the director's cut. He doesn't let anything get out that isn't exactly what he wanted. And I love it. That leads to I'm gonna tell three jokes. There's the classic joke about the moon landing, right? You've heard it, I'm sure.
Sure.
So yeah, the government faked the moon landing. They hired Stanley Kubrick to film and fake the moon landing, but he went way over budget because he insisted they do it on location, right? That's so great that he decided to do this. And he, you know, this, a lot of people think this is an anti-war movie or an anti-Marine Corps movie. No, he said, I want to make the greatest war movie of all time. That's what he was trying to do here. He didn't have an alternative, and he wanted to show the dehumanizing nature of it. And this speaks back to your why the hell would you want to go to boot camp after watching this, Harry, is because, you know, really it makes me question my sanity because this movie is about dehumanizing you, making you that killer that's capable of shooting that 10, 11, 12-year-old girl that's, you know, putting you in the same league with the door gunner who's like, you know, you shoot women and how do you shoot women and children? And, you know, by leading them thus. You know what I mean? You know, like that. Why do you want to be in that company? Why did I want to be Animal Mother? You know? And I can't answer that question. I guess I was 19, 18, 19 years old. But man, this movie really is about what it takes to create it. And it really informed a lot of my political views in the future because, you know what? People should watch this and understand what it takes to win a war because, God bless it, I don't want them to change the Marine Corps. Because guess what, Rob? Unless you want to have a pacifist foreign policy, this is what it takes to create a force capable of doing what is necessary to enforce a military agenda. That's what it takes right there. That's my serious moment. This is when they play the slow Brady music. Wah, 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 nah. You know, this is my serious moment. But this movie represents really, really, really what it takes for the United States to have a force that's going to go out and execute its foreign policy the way it needs to be done. So I'll say, watch this movie and understand that. This is a great distillation of it. So I don't think it's a protest movie. I think it's an informative movie. I think it, maybe he meant it as a protest movie, but I think it informs more than it protests. So anyway.
I never got the sense that Kubrick really had any much of an agenda in any of his films outside of presenting reality as best he saw it. I mean, there's a story you can flash back to when he was trying to make Dr. Strangelove, is that initially the take on Dr. Strangelove was much more serious. And then he recognized that, just the idea that there were people out there who thought that we could survive a nuclear holocaust was so absurd that the only way you could approach this material was as a comedy, which is why Dr. Strangelove is the movie that it is. And I mean, I don't take Full Metal Jacket as an anti-war movie or an anti-marine movie. It's certainly, as you say, it's presenting my sense of what it's really like. And, you know, that's something where I just say, I want to be as far away from that as humanly possible. You know, and so therefore, I'm never going to sign up. I'm not going to get drafted. And thank goodness for that, because I don't want to be involved in any of this. I mean, and that's not even including the fact that Sergeant, Sergeant Hartman gets shot by Pyle. I mean, not even including any of that stuff.
Just the
notion of being there and having to undergo such radical transformation is just so utterly terrifying. It's funny though, when I've seen this movie dozens of times, and it wasn't until I watched it just the most recent time for this episode. One of the scariest things about the whole opening sequence, and we're still only like the first half of this movie, is the fact that my memory of it is you don't see any other people. You just see the people on the base. And to me, it's like this could be 1968. It could be 2028, it could be 1928. I mean, to me, there's this real unreality to it. Now, that is inaccurate, because actually during the graduation scene, you see civilians in the stands watching them as they graduate.
But they're more of a prop.
Exactly. They don't get any lines. I mean, it's very isolating, and that to me is one of the scariest parts about it. Now, it's unfair, I would say, but most people remember just the first half. The second half of this movie, a lot of people are more down on, because it is more formless. I mean, it doesn't have Arlie Ermey being so ridiculously charismatic and terrifying, and it doesn't have Vincent D'Onofrio as we shift to watching Private Joker over actually in Vietnam. But nevertheless, I still like all of this second half of the film, because it's Modena's Joker, you know, like I think he allows you as an audience member to kind of imprint yourself a little bit on him, because we don't know anything about this guy. You know, like he's kind of a blank to a certain extent. And so I kind of like that you can sort of put yourself into his shoes a little bit. I mean, he's certainly more clever, more sarcastic, more caustic with his superiors than I would be. The whole, you know, sir, does this mean Anne Margaret's not coming? I mean, all that stuff.
But
I
mean, it's,
I think by the fact that Matthew Modine was a relative unknown to most moviegoers, it works in the movie's favor, is that he's just a little more of a blank in the second half of the movie.
Can I tell you something? Those people existed in every clime and place. There were jokers everywhere in the Marine Corps. We think civilians, you know, they get this. There's a couple different ways they think about servicemen and veterans and whatnot. One is the whole, you know, sort of weepy worship pedestal putting on kind of thing. Like we're off there living this austere Spartan life and whatever, and that's bullshit. And then the other one is this, I guess it's more of the same, I guess, in a way. Let me just take a step back. Let me recommend two things. One, watch The Pacific, you know, and two, watch this movie, and then three, watch Generation Kill. Have you seen Generation Kill?
No, I'm familiar with it, but I haven't seen it.
Watch it. If you want to understand the Marine Corps, watch it. Those three pieces of pop culture ephemera, right? Those three pieces, and even Jarhead, like I think Swaff did a great job, you know, of that ennui part of the Marine Corps, you know, that I want to kill something and they won't let me, you know, there's no one to kill. You know, the Marines are, I got to look up a quote. I can't look it up. I'm going to paraphrase it. I don't want to make noise that you'll have to delete. Eleanor Roosevelt has the best quote ever, and I am going to totally mangle it because I didn't do my homework and I didn't prepare. You know, she basically said, I love the Marines. Never have I seen a group of men with cleaner bodies or dirtier minds or higher morale or lower morals. You know, and,
wow.
And that freaking, hey, I still got three, freaking sums it up. We are Joker, every single one of us. No one is out there the noble, you know, I hesitate to say Christian because I don't want to make this at all a debate about politics, but this noble Christian warrior who's doing what he's doing to sacrifice for the country. We are out there saying the most disgusting things to one another. We are making the worst comments. The scene when he hooks up with Cowboy's platoon and they have a corpse, right? And the guy goes on that little soliloquy about how this is his favorite person and they should film it. You know, that's a common theme. There's a corpse scene in The Pacific. There's a corpse scene in Generation Kill, I think. I mean, it's just this, you've trained me to not to demonize this enemy and to be an absolute killing machine. Well, guess what? I'm going to respond to that psychologically. I'm going to be able to deal with it. If I'm going to be able to deal with it, I'm going to deal with it by joking about it. And it's going to be a wicked funny thing that no one in the world but another Marine is going to understand. So there you go. Can I lighten the mood for a second and tell you a joke?
Sure.
This is a joke that Matthew Modine told Stanley Kubrick. And this is the second joke he told him, but it's the one that I opened the book to, which just made that noise. Sorry. I have a joke for you, Stanley. See, you're in heaven. Oh, you already told me that one. No, this is different. You're in heaven. You're up there lying on a cloud, peaceful. Then you hear a voice, and Matthew Modine is Angel Gabriel. Yo, Stanley, how you been, baby? Listen, I got some great news from the big fella. He wants you to direct him a film, as Kubrick, clearing his throat. Direct him a film. I only direct what I produce, as Gabriel. Hold on there, buddy. Before you say no, listen to the lineup. Billy Shakespeare is going to write your script, as Kubrick. Billy Shakespeare. Yeah, baby. And Leo is building your sets. Da Vinci? Well, that all sounds great, but I only make movies I produce. Tell God I appreciate the offer, but hold on, kid. Michelangelo is your production designer? And no, I only direct film. Ludwig von Beethoven's going to score your film. You go through your routine, you look down at the ground, pull on your beard, you rub your eyes, and then as you look up at Gabriel, this is tough for you, you're going to break one of your rules. Shakespeare, Beethoven, Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and God batting cleanup. What do you say, Stanley? This could be the greatest movie ever made, says Stanley Kubrick. And then as Angel Gabriel says, great, there's just one more thing. Kubrick, one more thing? Gabriel, yeah, God's got this girlfriend. Right? Modine had a set of balls on him, and that is an entree into something I wanted to talk about, something I had to talk about with you. The ending of the movie. We see the ending of the movie. It's that great scene that mixes diegetic sound music and non-diegetic music, because it's really the Mickey Mouse people singing that. But you can see the lips moving of the Marines as they're marching out of Way City on fire, having done their job. Way City is one of those battles. It's, you know, it's Chapultepec. It's right up there. It's on the list of top tens for great Marine moments, right? And they're marching out of Way City, and they're singing the theme to the Mickey Mouse Club. And at the same time, you hear the actual Mickey Mouse Club singers singing it as well. That's the ending of the movie, right? He's just marching off. He lives. He, you know, life is life. And I think he does a little voiceover, right? I love his voiceovers. There's five or six of them. Some of them don't seem to make sense, but they do. They do. And he does a little voiceover, and he's done. The movie's over, right? Then we get fade to black, and you get the Rolling Stones come on, right? That was not how the movie was going to end. Kubrick had no idea how the movie was going to end. He thought he was going to kill Joker in some tragic way. You know, I think the original movie, the ending that Kubrick had decided on and that Modine liked, and it was that, Modine is, as a young child, an actor is playing as Modine. He's playing war in the backyard with his friends. And then he's running around and they're playing war and Modine's in a battle and it flashes back and forth. And then bop, 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 bop. You know, one of the other kids stands up and shoots at the kid Modine at the same time. A VC stands up with an AK and lights him up. And then it flashes to them both dying at the same time in the same way. And that was going to be the end of the movie. And Modine loved it. He loved it. But Kubrick didn't. He did not like it at all. And he kept going on, Matthew Modine. This is like a year and a half of filming, right? And so then he would get it in, and they were they were just going button heads about it. And Modine would say, I like it how it is. And Kubrick says, yeah, I don't. Like, what about this? And he goes, no, I like it how it is. And how about this? And then at one time, they were in Kubrick's office, and there was four of them sitting around. Adam Baldwin, I don't know the names of all the actors, but most of the main characters there in the Vietnam part were around, and they're sitting around, and they're all making up endings of the movie, and Kubrick's liking it. And then it comes to Modine, and he's a total shit about it. Modine said, and he admits this in his diary, he says, I was a complete asshole, and I was insulting to Stanley Kubrick, and I just sort of said it, and then I left, about how he liked the traditional ending of the movie. And so they were on the outs for months during filming, and of course Kubrick didn't let it affect his work, but Modine could feel it. He was no longer invited to come and talk to Stanley, and like all these things. And so they're going around and around, and they're doing this final scene, and that final scene was filmed on a soundstage, and they had to take breaks because it got too hot. All the fire in the building with the girl with the sniper, right? And Modine is emotionally done. He's physically done. He just can't take it at all. He's just ready to scream. He's at his wit's end, as if he has been through combat for this long. And after one take, and they have to take a break, and it's a really frustrating thing because they had just done all this work and set up explosions and then had to redo it. And Kubrick comes up to him and says, about the ending. And Modine turns and he snaps at him and he goes, I live. My Joker lives. He has to live to remember Hartman, and he has to live to remember Pyle splattering his brains. He has to live to remember Cowboy dying in his arms. He has to live to remember all of this horrible shit, and he carries it around with him for the rest of his life. And Kubrick goes, that's it. That's the ending. And that is how that movie ended the way it ended. And I think it's such a great story. And we think about Kubrick as a perfectionist, but he's not a perfectionist in the typical sense of it, where he has a plan and you have to follow his plan exactly, you know, a crumb out of line. No, he's a perfectionist who doesn't give you instruction. He doesn't know. It's like pornography in the Supreme Court. I can't tell you what it is, but I'll know it when I see it. That's right. Kubrick's filming method. You know, he doesn't know what he wants, but he'll know it when he sees it. That's why he does 86 takes. And that was that moment where they were made up. That's it. They were fine. Their relationship was healed. And they were better. And the movie was better, and the movie ended in that way, and it's perfect.
I'm glad that they didn't go with that ending. I think this movie works because it exists in the here and now, and I think if they had all of a sudden started flashing back, it would put up an emotional remove there that would have dulled the effect. So I'm glad they didn't.
You know, but again, that was another element to this movie. You think about it. Now, I coach not well. I'm not really qualified, but I coach my daughter's track and field team. I coach the throwers, and I'll relate a great movie like this, a perfect movie, to throwing the discus. You know, throwing the discus requires you to do 10 different things at once, perfectly. And this is essentially a perfect discus throw. Think about it. You can picture throwing a discus in your head, right? All those moving. You know, can you see it? Can you see it in your head? You know, you can see it. That's what this is like. This is like this had to happen. And you know what? It's not luck. It wasn't luck that he cast D'Onofrio. It wasn't luck that the movie ended the way it did. It wasn't luck. You know why? Because it's Kubrick. And he made it. And, you know, he made it work that way. And he kept going until he found perfection. And so I don't want to talk about it and demean it and talk about it like it's luck or whatever. You know, lines up and it's perfect. And your assessment of the second half of this movie was brilliant. I didn't comment on that. Yes, the second half of this movie is perfect, but you have to think about it more, which makes it harder to appreciate.
I do want to ask you, the scene where Joker meets is at the grave, that grave with all the corpses and the lime.
And God bless you for asking this. They talk
to that general, and I, again, as a muggle, as someone who's never been in this situation, you say to yourself, come on, is there really a guy like that? And I have to ask you, is there a guy like that who says things like, we have to keep our wits about it until this peace craze blows over? I mean, people really talk like that? I mean, I know Curtis LeMay talked like that, but do most guys in the military talk like that?
No. Okay, so here's the thing about the Marine Corps. The best officer I ever had, and I won't say best, let's not use superlatives, one of the greatest examples of leadership I ever had is now a one-star general. He's probably going to get his second star before he gets out. He was actually a gunnery sergeant. He was the same rank as Hartman before he even became an officer. The dude is, his name is, I'm actually not going to say his name because of the field that he's associated with, intelligence, and that's not appropriate. But Heavy D, man, just an amazing, amazing guy. Unfortunately, for every Heavy D, there was another guy whose name I won't name because I'm going to say something bad about him, and that's just not appropriate. He was a martinet. He would have said something like that colonel. He wasn't a general. He was a colonel. He would have said something like that colonel, and he would have meant it. But he would have meant it in a way that wasn't thoughtful. And, you know, there's a spectrum. You know, if Heavy D was the best and this other guy was the worst, a bunch of them fell on that spectrum. You asked this question, are there people like that? The Marine Corps is full of people. And you got to think, that environment, what kind of people go through it? And we've discussed that. Who looks at Full Metal Jacket and says, yes, please, right? So it's full of people who say yes, please to Full Metal Jacket. And then you got to think about the spectrum of those people. You get the Swaffords. You get people like, I hope, me, who are thoughtfully challenging themselves to a great challenge, to a great and terrible challenge, right? And then you get other people who, you know, are like, what's his name? I can't remember the photographer that he's forced to take with him into Way City.
Rafterman.
I want to get to the field. I want to get some, blah, 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 blah. And then you get that. And then the third one is the true psychotics, you know, like that colonel, or the people who suspend their humanity and win positions of leadership. Yeah, those people exist, man. They exist. The colonel took us to Desert Storm. We weren't supposed to go. He was a full colonel, or a lieutenant colonel, rather, and he was supposed to detach one or two of our companies and send them to Desert Storm. But, because first Radio Battalion out of the West Coast was the one that was supposed to go, or Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii, at the time. We just all got our shit together and drove down and parked it. You know, we parked it, then we all drove over to the airfield, and we flew to Desert Storm, and he took the whole battalion. And then he spent about 2 months avoiding, you know, getting shit canned for it. And you know what? It worked out for him. He got his full bird, and then he retired. You know what I mean? So that kind of guy took a bunch of people to war that didn't have to go because he wanted to have the opportunity to lead a battalion in combat. And he is just as full of hubris and bad judgment as you think he would be. Still a good guy. Still actually not even a really, really bad officer. But, you know, just exists on the spectrum of the Marine Corps. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, but the reason I'm happy you brought up that scene is because I feel like Kubrick used it to show the horror of war so effectively. You know, he didn't show, he showed the door gunner shooting at civilians, right? And he showed that. But this was a real event. This really happened. Way City, the NVA came in and messed that place up and killed a lot of civilians. And so I think this was his way of making sure, and I don't know because he's dead, and the hundreds of hours of documentary footage his daughter shot will never be seen by us, ever. You know, we don't know for sure, but I think this was his way of saying, I am not protesting. I'm not saying the Marines shouldn't be here doing what they're doing in there. The Marines are not the villain. The other side is bad too. War is bad. War is damaging. War kills. War is misery. You think about the two hooker scenes, right? You know, that's the dehumanization of women.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this, and, you know, pre-integration of the services, right? You know, they were fighting. They were fucking. Yeah, there's number three. You know, they were hookers of the Vietnamese, and they were used and spit up and chewed up and spit out. And it's a real shit show. I mean, when you look at that, that was the life. And actually, if you think about sex tourism today, Thailand, right? That's what comes to mind. Sex tourism, Thailand, right? You know, you can, if you want to go get your rocks off, you fly internationally, you go to Thailand. That happened. Thailand is the way it is today because we invaded Vietnam. We had to get a safe place to send our troops, and we couldn't send them to Japan because Japan couldn't provide this kind of service, right? So we sent them to Thailand, and Thailand was a relatively conservative country. And now that post-Vietnam, we have the influence of the Vietnam War is being felt today in the fact that people go there to have sex with underage girls. You know? Yeah, I know, right? So that all, you got to think about that. And that scene there speaks to that devastation. I mean, of course, he couldn't capture it. He captured and there's a third Booker scene that isn't in the movie that they did film, and I'll tell you about it if you want. But it's
considering the artistry here and all the different things that Kubrick is trying to say, it is sort of tragic in a way that the most famous scene probably that people know from this movie, even if they've never seen it.
Pop songs. It's Me Love You Long Time.
Yeah, is right. Is the Me So Horny scene. I mean, it just became so famous. And I do want to mention that actress. Her name is Papillon Sue. She had basically one previous credit, which is in A View to a Kill. The James Bond movie, but this is her bid for a cinematic immortality is that scene. And it makes me, it's a great scene and it's really compelling, but it does make me sad that a movie that has so much on its mind, which every Stanley Kubrick movie does, you know, can be distilled down to just that sort of.
But you can't let it get you sad though, because when someone mentions it, oh yeah, that movie, then you can take the turn and say, hey, my Marine buddy talked about that. You know, then tell them about Thailand, man. You know what? That was a real kill. So what's worse? What's worse? The fact that we went and invaded Vietnam and then, like, all those people died? Or that hundreds and thousands of women and trans women live pretty horrible lives in Thailand servicing international sex tourists, right? And are completely devalued as people. So that's a horrible outcome. And I have no qualms with that. Me So Horny being there. And you know what? And you know, what's that line? Stupid is, it stupid does. And people are going to sample it and they're going to celebrate that kind of sexuality and be idiots about it. But you know what? If you want to appreciate that film, if there's so many things to take from that film, and yeah, you're right, it is kind of sad that that's the one, whatever. But man, I have no problem with that because it's an opportunity to have a discussion.
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap up here a little bit as we scale down, but there is a couple just sort of random things I want to get to before we wrap up. First of all, and some of the stuff I read, I don't know whether it's true or not, because I don't buy, like, I read that Arnold Schwarzenegger turned down the role of Animal Mother. I don't know if I buy that. I don't believe that Stanley Kubrick would have offered the role to Arnold Schwarzenegger. I just can't picture that. Arnold Schwarzenegger
I can't comment, but I wouldn't say it would be impossible. You know what I mean?
I just can't picture, Kubrick wanting somebody that would be that distracting in this movie. I mean, it would completely take you out of the reality of this movie. To see
right,
Arnold.
Yeah, because he carries so much so much other pop culture meaning. Sure.
Right. 86, 87, this is post-Terminator.
I would say that's crap. He would not.
I don't know if I would buy that. Yeah. Apparently, Private Joker was for a long time going to be played by Anthony Michael Hall, but him and Kubrick could not apparently come to some sort of deal, and it all fell through, which is, I have to say, that's a pretty dumb move on Anthony Michael Hall's part, because I would argue that any actor, if you have a chance of being in a Stanley Kubrick movie, you should take it. You should have taken it. You know, not, because you're going to most likely end up being in a very, very good movie. This is based on a book.
Yep.
Have you read the book, The Short Timers, by Gustav Hasford?
I did, but I don't recall it. I read it when I think the year started with 19, but it may have started with 1980 something. You know what I mean?
Right. Okay.
It's that long ago. So yeah, I'll probably reread it now that you've asked me that question, and I have to say I don't remember it.
After this movie, this movie was only nominated for one Oscar, which is Best Adapted Screenplay. It did not win. Kubrick went on to work on a film called The Aryan Papers, which was about the Holocaust, and apparently even that material was just so dark, even for him, he had to abandon it, which is why, if you look at the arc of his career, as his films go on, the gap between them gets larger and larger and larger. You've got 5 years between Barry Lyndon and The Shining, then you've got 7 years between The Shining and Full Metal Jacket, and then you get 12 years between Full Metal Jacket and his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. So you see, he just kind of got slower and slower and slower. One thing that we did mention, and I do want to get in, is the use of music in this
Thank
movie,
you.
It's amazing. I mean, you'll never hear the Surfing Bird the same way again
Nope.
After you've seen it used in this movie.
And there was two pieces of diegetic music used. And I love that term because I love the and you know what it is, of course, but to your audience members, diegetic.
Right, it's music in the reality of the film.
It's Wayne and Garth singing Queen in their Gremlin. You know,
actual
that's
characters listening to music that's
Music that exists within it. And the non-diegetic, and I was trying to count this time when I was listening to it. And I think there was seven songs, not counting the final, fade black, that were inserted into it. And in each case, he uses them so effectively, either to, like the boot, these boots are made for walking when they're opening up on Vietnam, wasn't
right,
that it?
Right.
Oh, geez, man, you're right. I mean, that's so it keys in, and then there's another one towards the end. And they get into that firefight, and that's a great scene because it's inconclusive. No one knows what the hell happens at the end of the firefight. They just move on. And then at the end of that scene and sort of when they're moving on, it's another song starts. And it's just, he just keys it in, and it's just – it's there to say, okay, that was the end of that. How is that? And that's so good because it captures that – you don't know. The fog of war is there in everyone. And, we see these top, people playing video games, and you see everything, and you're managing everything. Man, that's not it at all. It's more like that inconclusive ending, like, is this over now? Okay, let's move on. So, okay.
I mean, I love how, like I mentioned, that the movie opens with that song, Hello Vietnam, over white lettering over a black screen, and then it ends with the Rolling Stones painted black with white lettering over a black screen, but it gives you an indication of how far we've traveled
in
2 hours.
Well, there's two more things I want to say about the music. The other song was the use of the Marines hymn in boot camp, and they're playing the Marines hymn in the background. And it may not have been, but it felt like it was. It felt like it was playing over a tinny, crappy speaker on Parasan, right? Didn't you get that feeling from that? It was so in the background and so not – in the foreground, like most of the other music, I just felt like it was part of the scene. And that was great because that song is so significant to Marines. I mean, we have to stand up anytime we hear it, And I don't care if you're 90, you get out of your damn wheelchair and you still lock your body when you hear that song, right? And the other one was the Mickey Mouse song, and that's super important. I know we talked about it, but I want to talk about it again because the significance of it, it's not just a goofy ending, like, okay, we're done. No, this was some Mickey Mouse bullshit. That's the point of that song. We went in here and we did this and we cleared out Way City. And honestly, dude, it was one of the greatest battles in Marine Corps history. I mean, we're talking Guadalcanal. Iwo Jima's more significant. Quezon, right up there with Chosin Reservoir and all these really famous and important Marine Corps battles, right? And Way City. And they're storming out of there and they're saying, they're walking that, striding out of there, victorious, and they're singing this Mickey Mouse song because it was Mickey Mouse bullshit. And guess what? War is Mickey Mouse bullshit. It almost always can be avoided. It almost always has a reason other than the one that's stated, and it's always, 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 always bad for everyone involved. There's never anyone that profits. There might be people who profit, but there's never anything good that comes out of war. You can say, we designed medical treatments for it. Yeah, that's good. But it's like saying it's horrible. But at the same time, it's necessary. And having this Marine Corps to go out there and do this, it exists in the world. And therefore, we must be able to do it. And this is what we need in order to get it done. And so that's the Marine Corps existence. You are the tool. You're the hammer handed to the government, with which it pounds things into pulp, and your life is shit, but you love it and you love your brothers and you love that you've done it and you're proud to do it, even when it's Mickey Mouse bullshit, because you're one of the best. Joker, if I met the real character Joker today down at the VFW or in the mall or wherever at my church, he and I would laugh about this movie and we would trade stories about how miserable our lives were. And we would hug, and it would be awesome. So there you go.
We're going to end it here. I think that's the best way to end this episode, talking about Full Metal Jacket. This is a movie that was not universally beloved by critics, but then as director Sidney Pollack talks about in the Kubrick documentary, that you give these Kubrick movies a couple of years, and they become classics. And that's true of virtually every movie he made from the 60s through the 70s into the 80s. And I'd say this is definitely one of those films. So, Terry, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. This was really important to me to be able to speak with someone who has a knowledge of this world and be able to sort of appreciate this film for the things that I'm never going to be able to appreciate because I don't live in that world. And so I thank you very much for coming on to do this with me.
It's my pleasure. And the only other thing I would mention is, you know, what brought this on? And we've been talking about it for years. But, you know, Arlie Ermey passed away recently. He's a great man. He had his own opinions, but he really was a great man who was a great representative for the Corps throughout his life and in this movie. The Corps didn't like him, the movie at the time, but we all Marines did, and we love Gunny. Yeah, so there you go.
All right. Well, I said I'm not going to do any plugs. Everybody knows where you can find back episodes of the show and stuff. So I'm just going to say thanks, everybody, for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
All right.
Drop your cocks and grab your socks. Today is Sunday, divine worship at 0800. Get your bunks made and get your uniforms on. Police call will commence in 2 minutes. Private Cowboy, Private Joker.
Sir, yes, sir. Sir, yes, sir.
As soon as you finish your bunks, I want you two turds to clean the head.
Sir, yes, sir.
I want that head so sanitary and squared away that the Virgin Mary herself would be proud to go in there and take a dump.
Sir, yes, sir.
Private Joker, do you believe in the Virgin Mary?
Sir, no, sir.
Well, Private Joker, I don't believe I heard you correctly.
Sir, the private said no, sir, sir.
Well, you little maggot, you make me want to vomit. You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Sir, negative, sir.
Private Joker, are you trying to offend me?
Sir, negative, sir. Sir, the private believes that any answer he gives will be wrong, and the senior drill instructor will beat him harder if he reverses himself, sir.
Who's your squad leader, scumbag?
Sir, the private squad leader is Private Snowball, sir.
Private Snowball.
Sir, Private Snowball, report his honor, sir.
Private Snowball, you're fired. Private Joker is promoted to squad leader.
Sir, aye, aye, sir.
Yes, affair, scumbag.
Sir, aye, aye, sir.
Private Pyle.
Sir, Private Pyle, reporting his orders, sir.
Private Pyle, from now on, Private Joker is your new squad leader, and you will bunk with him. He'll teach you everything. He'll teach you how to pee.
Sir, yes, sir.
Private Joker is silly and he's ignorant, but he's got guts, and guts is enough. Now, you ladies, carry on.
Sir, aye, sir.